Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 93 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 1014. Okay. We finally wrapped up that long block on the evolution of religion last week, and we're ready to start this new, rather extended block again about Melchizedek. Immediately about Machavent and Melchizedek himself, when he was here roughly 4,000 years ago. And then we go into a series of papers about the Melchizedek missionaries extending out far and wide, spreading the essence of what Melchizedek taught. And in the process, as we mentioned in the latter part of the evolution of religion papers there, in the process of following those teachings out with the missionaries, you engage the evolutionary religion in all those various regions. It gets influenced, and it offers the revelators the opportunity to to give us the beginnings of a number of those primary evolutionary religions that we were talking about in the preceding paper, that in part take you up to the arrival of Michael of Nebadon as Jesus, but not just taking you that far, but really taking you into what comes forward to the present time with all of the various main religious traditions. So there's a lot to cover. We'll get a lot of history, a lot of engagement of some of the details of the existent religions. And of course, the main thing that you're doing is focusing in on exactly what the ghost cult framework with dual spiritism and whatnot, ends up looking like in India or China or the Near East or what have you. How it gets little snippets of revelatory influence tossed in, whether or not they have a greater emphasis on the recognition of unity that they got through a more philosophic reflection, like happened a lot in the East, began without a definitive personalized God consciousness, and only in very recent times beginning to get to that, or whether or not like with the Hebrews, they start with a very definitive individuality concept, and it gets fostered forward, and then needs actually some influence of unity, reverence to make it a little less biased, to get it a little bit more objective and potentialized for revelation to really lift it up to higher levels. So it ends up working both ways, favoring their individuality consciousness or their past, kind of getting them into that mode, and then those on the other side with the unity consciousness. So we got all that complexity. But before we do that, they need to take us back and introduce us to the actual individual that gets recorded in the Bible as Melchizedek, and who spawned a tradition in the Near East, lots of mythological tradition that was floating around, feeds into the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, that stuff that's outside of the Old Testament, not to mention exactly how when they put together the Old Testament, when the Jews put together the Old Testament during the exile, how they reworked all those stories that they had to replace Abraham interacting with Melchizedek, what actually happened with quote unquote Abraham interacting with God, with Yahweh, how they reworked those stories. But we all know they didn't totally eliminate him. They're back there in Genesis. There's that mysterious reference of why does Abraham seem to have all of this adoration and respect for some quote unquote heathen religionist, as it seems to appear there in the Old Testament. So it's all very mysterious, and so they need to get all of that out of the mists of the past and help us to understand exactly what happened historically that produced the little snippets of stories and traditions that we have. And then in the process, and starting out, as you'll see, they'll give us some reminders of the Melchizedeks in general, and in particular the Melchizedek receivers that are here on the planet, because of at this time that we're about to read, because the rebellion hasn't the basic issues of the rebellion and the default haven't been addressed yet. Jesus hasn't gotten there yet. We're still 2,000 years away from Jesus arriving, or you'll see they'll even start back 3,000 years before Jesus' arrival. Okay, so I think that's enough. Kind of just general contextualizing, because you got this whole block of papers on Melchizedek. Let's see how they start us here.
Paper 93, Machaventa Melchizedek. The Melchizedeks are widely known as emergency sons, for they engage in an amazing range of activities on the worlds of a local universe. When any extraordinary problem arises, or when something unusual is to be attempted, it is quite often a Melchizedek who accepts the assignment. The ability of the Melchizedek sons to function in emergencies and on widely divergent levels of the universe, even on the physical level of personality manifestation, is peculiar to their order. Only the life carriers share to any degree this metamorphic range of personality function.
Okay, so, obviously, hearkening you all the way back, into part two, one could even go back and refresh your memory and read those sections that in the paper that talks about the local universe sons. Go back and read those sections about the Melchizedeks and remind yourself of some of the basic aspects of that order of being. But they're reminding you the key thing that's immediately in play here. Remember, they tell you back there that you have all sorts of vicissitudes that crop up in the normal administrative order of things in the universe of universes. And, occasionally they don't just let evolution play through some circuitous process and sort it all out. They actually send some emergency sons in to add a little dash of linearity, if you will, to a meandering evolutionary phenomenon, and see if they, they have to be careful to not, like, if it's in the wake of a rebellion, you can't jump in and micromanage to where you're in rebellion, just doing that. And there's still a respect of the evolutionary process, but they come in and with an objective, appropriate, gentle hand, add a little bit of guidance to a world or a system of worlds. In our case, since it was a system rebellion, to to help it to not drift too far off the rails before another official dispensational son comes along. Yeah.
Does it get like that because of free will?
Everything gets like that because of free will, right? I mean, the wild card, you know, in a universe predicated on absolute law, you know, yeah, sure, absolute law is downstepped into time and space and what have you, but still, a universe that's, you know, ultimately predicated on absolute law, the only thing that could possibly make anything stray one iota from an infinite absolute purposing would be something that has effectively an equal absoluteness. Our personalities have an absolute dimension. We have free will. You know, they can calculate, you know, the doings of physical energy, mindal energy, spiritual energy to endless decimal places, predict everything very precisely, including the whole, you know, triune association of the three energies. I mean, that's all very predictable. The only thing you can't predict is personality activity, right? That's a wild card. That's free will. It's literally free. Now, it isn't directly, completely free, you know, for me, say, outside of the upper domain and the hourglass analogy of my mind, right, in that domain where I'm sovereign, there's all kinds of personal and impersonal phenomena. If I try to assert a sovereignty beyond my inner life out into the external world, you know, that can thwart, you know, I want to move this cup, you know. Well, I mean, something could easily, you know, prevent me from moving that, you know. A meteor could fly in and smash the cup before I could get to it. I mean, a million things could happen, you know, that would prevent me. But in the inner life, absolutely nothing. Not even God himself can, you know, stop anything there. I have absolute sovereign free will there. You know, so obviously there's going to be some degree to which that sovereignty leaks out and can cause havoc, be it rebellion or default or even something just lesser. I mean, even if there isn't a rebellion or default, you might still end up through a vast conspiracy of circumstances, you know, having a situation under a certain world or under certain circumstances where Melchizedek's need to help out for some reason, right? Whatever it is, you know, and it doesn't have to be even on worlds. It could be, you know, in the universe administration at large, something on a local system headquarters world, something at the constellation level, whatever. Right? They're just there at any level to help out. If there needs to be some additional fostering guidance supplied. Yep.
Who assigns them? Who sends them?
I mean, you've got a vast hierarchy of possible assignment, but you have a lead Melchizedek. His name's Father Melchizedek. You know, the term they use to designate him, along with Gabriel. Those two are side by side leading the local universe sort of as co-CEOs, but obviously they don't delegate, I mean, they don't assign everything directly, they delegate some down a hierarchy, but when all is said and done, you know, they're those lead administrative individuals are there to assign people to tasks, that, you know, where they need to be assigned. And in that sense, let's take a moment before we get in any further, just to, so you've got this name from the Bible, Melchizedek, right? I mean, that's a Hebrew word, okay? And the revelators here are you know, for obvious reasons, going to use that term. They're going to talk about someone, you know, that we're, you know, we're referring to as Melchizedek. That isn't some just, you know, imaginary name in the Bible or something. Okay, there was definitely a person, and the Bible is referring to him as Melchizedek. Now, what is the literalness of that Hebrew name? It literally means King of Righteousness. The Tzedek part is righteousness. You know, Melchizedek, King of Righteousness. But we already saw, you know, in the first two words, the Melchizedeks, you know, they just, it's like obviously they've grabbed a hold of that word, and they're not just going to use it for some individual's name. They're going to use it to designate an order of beings. So what are they doing there? Well, not only that, you know that they take what isn't literally a suffix, the D-E-K part, but it kind of sort of is. In Hebrew, you have tzedak, which is righteous, and tzedek, which is righteousness. So, you know, that end latter part changes, see, when you kind of do what we do in English, where we add an S, you know, that noun-forming suffix. And so they just grab that and they use it as a suffix so that you can set up a set of parallel names with Veranda Dex and Lananan Dex. If you just kind of think about that Ness suffix that we use in righteousness, it's like, well, okay, so it's probably kind of indicating a certain flavor of expression, and the rest of the word, like Voranda, that must be giving you the flavor of the expression. You know, like Veranda Deck is very father-like expression. What would you, you know, if you generalize this and, you know, set aside the literalness of king, like, well, what would be kind of the general sense then? What they're saying is there's, and Melchizedek is the primary righteous expression of a local universe descending son. Right? You have all these different local universe descending sons. Right? These Melchizedeks would be, you know, the primary righteous expression of a local universe descending son. So that's kind of the way you can take it out of the literalness of the Hebrew and out of the Old Testament and the book of Hebrews and the New Testament and think of how they're using sort of the spirit of it, right? The spirit of the word as a generalized term. And then what they do if they, you know, sometimes they just, you know, like the author of these papers is A. Melchizedek, it says, okay? But every once in a while we know they give a kind of a quote-unquote first name to a Melchizedek, like Machaventa Melchizedek or Malvatia or, you know, or Manavandat or, you know, whatever. They've got some of these individuals that they add another name. They don't just refer to him as generically as A. Melchizedek. What's up with that? That's, as you begin to reflect on that selective addition of a quote-unquote first name, it dawns on you that those are Melchizedeks that were part of the 12 Melchizedek receivers that were here from the rebellion until Jesus' times. You know, they were kind of leading the planet for a very long time. They're obvious individuals to bring into play to write some of the papers for the fifth epical revelation. And they're definitely going to know of that which they speak in certain special areas. They were here for a very long time. You know, as we all know, we'll get to it shortly here. Machaventa, he's one of the 12, the one that is going to be incarnated on this special mission. Okay, and I've yet to figure out the etymology of Machaventa. One of these days, maybe I'll figure that one out. But if you look at that etymology, notes that I've put together. You know, I have a couple of them that have these additional names, you know, that I have figured out. Anyway, so that's, you know, that's the basics with the Melchizedek. Now let's just look at the other things they point out here. You know, an extraordinary problem, they say, or when something unusual is to be attempted. She notice it doesn't, it obviously doesn't have to be a rebellion or a fall, you know, necessarily. Just that there's something that, it's like, well, there isn't a whole order of beings made just for that issue. Well, coincidentally, there's a very flexible being that can adapt itself, modify itself to fit into just about any unusual situation where, you know, if only we had a being kind of like this, like, it's okay, I'll kind of fill that role. That's what the Melchizedek's for, and that's what they're referring to in the latter part of that paragraph, where the ability of the Melchizedek sons to function in emergencies and on widely divergent levels of the universe, even on the physical level of personality manifestation, is peculiar to their order. Remember how we did that way back when we were in part two and doing the Melchizedek's. They have an ability to, you know, without anyone helping them, just their own internal knob-turning, you know, if you will, ability to modify the physical manifestation of their body form. From a being that is, you know, innately, you know, sort of at the up, you know, towards the upper levels of a more spirit energy like body being in the local universe, all the way down to something that is, you know, manifests just like my corporeal body. Okay, and they aren't changing bodies. I mean, remember we've talked about this. The Melchizedek's really show you that there's kind of really only one body for all beings, and that body, because of the variability potential of energy systems, can be modified to express in a lot of different ways. Right? It can express in a fixed form like a seraphim, or a fixed form like a veranda deck, or what have you. And some beings, like Melchizedek's, have a little bit of internal variability. A secondary midwayer can modify his, you know, energization a little bit, but the Melchizedek's can modify it over the whole range. They could manifest as a seraphim-like being. You know, they can even manifest, like they're saying, in a physical level. Remember the Melchizedek life carrier thing, where literally they morph themselves into a physical manifestation and, along with a material daughter, procreate midsoniters. Okay? All right, so this isn't just, you know, a false front body. No, this is, you know, the whole works, including all the plumbing. All right? I mean, this is the full body. All right? In every way. Now, what we're going to talk about here, though, is not them just manifesting in physical fashion like they do when they're an attendant, one of the 12 Melchizedek's that attend a magisterial son and a magisterial, you know, their first magisterial mission. Not like that. This is different. The Machaventa is going to be incarnated, and we'll talk about that later. But then remember, they also remind you that the life carriers have a little bit of variable energy manifestation, but they can't do it to themselves. Remember that? It has to be done to them. There's sort of three different levels. There's their normal mid-level that they're created at. Then they can be modified into a down-stepped expression for when they actually need to manipulate physical things to literally design the life and implant the life on a new world. And then there's also then subsequently, and they're all done with all overseeing the life on a world, they're modified into a more spirit, you know, more angelic, like you might say, you know, more spirit being like mode of expression. like the life carriers that are still resident on the planet here, that just, you know, selected to stay on and were given permission to stay on. They were modified into that more spirit energy-like manifestation. See, but that's done to them. You know, special, you know, helper beings have to come in and modify their energy form. But the Melchizedeks can just dial themselves up and down and manifest in all these different ways. Very interesting beings. Yep.
Do they have a gender, or are they genderless?
It's not a coincidence that they're called descending sons, right? Because they literally manifest in male fashion, right? If you want to think about why that is, just as a little aside, you know, why aren't there beings that are able to, like, go from a higher level and morph into, say, a physical female and be, a womb for life? That isn't done because, see, that would be a fundamental disruption of the innately significant nature of a mortal woman. Remember, the hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny? A lot of the mysteries of how life is subtly influenced, and it isn't just the, you know, the material mechanical thing that current science thinks it is, right? That it has all of this relationship to mind energy and spirit energy, not to mention life animation and all that. A lot of that comes together in the sort of innately, slightly transcendent nature that is a female. A female embodies, you know, a measure of the greater wholeness of the cosmos. You know, they're not as part-like as a male. See, that has to be very precisely designed to fit into the place at a certain level. The more part-like male is kind of more like Henry Ford's, you know, interchangeable parts. You know, this Melchizedek is kind of even functioning like that. It's like, oh, you need this kind of part? Okay, let me morph you into that. You know, see, there. It reminds you of the fundamental difference between males and females. You don't have just sort of this wild, random, you know, morphing place. You know, remember, female's place and male's direction, that fundamental difference. Place can't be placeless. Place can't be movable. You know, it has a place. But direction, okay, that's a movable thing. You know, you can dial the direction all around as you desire. Right. So, just that little aside. When Machaventa, if Machaventa, you know, hadn't incarnated, if he'd just manifested physically, right, he's a male, right? It's not like he's morphing into a male. He is a male, right? I mean, again, this, you know, all the male parts aren't just magically coming out of nowhere. The being has it, even though he's not a procreating being, unless he's morphed down to the physical level. But it just reminds you, like we're saying, there's this fundamental nature that, you know, our bodies are much more an expression of something much more transcendent than they appear. Right? The fact that a Melchizedek, which is a very high quote unquote spirit being, right, can just manifest just like this, right? And you could examine him just like you'd examine me, and, you know, he's got all the ductwork and whatnot that I do. He's got a gallbladder, and he's got fingernails, and he's got, you know, he's got hair follicles, and I mean, you know, that's one of the things that's so stunning to come to terms with when you first start studying the Revelation. You know, you get it, the beginnings of that early on when they tell you all beings are domiciled on material abodes. You know, and suddenly you're jerked out of your mystical musings, you know, of spirit beings that sort of just float amorphously, you know, or whatnot. It's like, no, every being, even the universal Father himself, stands on a material abode. Right? Matter isn't some sort of secondary, you know, issue. It's a primary, it's a fundamental grounding, individuating fact of reality. And, you know, that's just the beginning, that all beings are domiciled on material abodes. But they're also very literal in the same way we are. It would obviously have to be in some way very literal if they're going to be domiciled on material abodes. Right? They can't be some amorphous, intangible thing. How would they ever know there was a material abode to stand on if they were so amorphous, right?
Maybe not. Material you and I always think about.
Well, right, the material of the Isle of Paradise is a pretty fancy material, but you definitely don't want to think of it as spirit substance or mind energy. It's, you know, it's material substance, the fanciest material substance.
The male thing on the Melchizedek, oftentimes the angels are
referred to on the female side. Yeah, now, see, in that regard, the reason that the angels are, you know, referred to as she's, that's because they're fundamentally working as the hands for the creative mother spirit. So they're functioning in, you know, in that extended she-like mode. But, you know, they, you know, they're never a, you know, literally a procreative womb. Okay, they aren't that literally she. However, like we've, you know, you can't help but wonder when guardian seraphim are taking possessions of souls after death, you know, and taking them to the resurrection halls of Mansonia number one, you know, it's like, well, do they carry them in a gilded box, you know, or how do they get them there? How you know, the soul's a literal Marantia brain, it's a literal object. Wouldn't it seem totally natural, you know, since they're sort of, you know, the direct expressions of the creative mother spirit, and they're called she's for that reason, wouldn't maybe they just keep them within their energy presence, kind of like they're unwombed, sort of, right? You know, kind of like unfertilized eggs, which is, of course, exactly what your soul is until it fuses with a thought adjuster. It's effectively an unfertilized egg. So, you know, there may be some degree to which, see, at least the seraphim, kind of, sort of, maybe, you know, have a little bit more of what we think of as a mother-like nature. anyway, we're going way off on, you know, a little bit of speculation there. We don't know that for certain, but, you know, that's not an unreasonable speculation about guardian seraphim transporting souls. Okay, so back to this. So anyway, you've got the point is that you've got all sorts of varied emergency or unusual situations that need to be addressed, and the Melchizedeks do it. And now they're going to remind you, boy, is our world needed Melchizedeks, right? Because even before the rebellion, we were an oddball world. All right, so let's read this next paragraph and remind yourself of that.
The Melchizedek Order of Universe Sonship has been exceedingly active on Urantia. A corps of 12 served in conjunction with the life carriers. A later corps of 12 became receivers for your world shortly after the Caligastia secession and continued in authority until the time of Adam and Eve. These 12 Melchizedeks returned to Urantia upon the default of Adam and Eve, and they continued thereafter as planetary receivers on down to the day when Jesus of Nazareth, as the Son of Man, became the titular planetary prince of Urantia.
Let's just throw in a little comment about that last little item. Does anyone remember when Jesus became the titular planetary prince of Urantia? From birth to leaving the world was that? Anyone recall?
Transfiguration.
No, not long before. Long before that, it was. I'll give you a hint. It was before the public ministry. On Mount Hermon, exactly. All right, because think about it just in logical terms. Even though Caligastia rebels, he's still titular planetary prince. So until someone directly confronts him and sets him aside, as Jesus got permission and did, as a first circler on Mount Hermon, right? No one else could be titular planetary prince. And as soon as Caligastia wasn't someone is, Jesus, became titular planetary prince on Mount Hermon there. When he engaged Satan and Caligastia.
Titular meaning?
In title. He holds the title. He hasn't come here and set up a planetary headquarters. He's literally functioning. And of course, subsequently we get the vice planetary prince of Machaventa, at some point that vicegerent planetary prince will actually directly assume the title as planetary prince. But right now, in title, Michael of Nebadon, dash Jesus of Nazareth is the titular planetary prince.
Even to this day.
What was that?
Even to this day.
Even to this day, yeah. So he's still the planetary prince. He will be until one day Machaventa, appears and says, "Hello, my name is Machaventa Melchizedek, and I'm the ruler of this world." There won't be any question about it. You won't have to speculate if he's still. Machaventa will appear, and he will literally build a planetary headquarters. It will be, a crazy thing for the planet to come to terms with.
Be covered on CNN.
To have an overt planetary headquarters again, which we haven't had for 200,000 years.
Actually, they're
going to vilify. Right. But, we've talked about that. That's, on a normal world, it's not supposed to be so easy to imagine that we're just a bunch of blobs of protoplasm in an infinitely empty universe. As soon as there's will creatures, there's a planetary prince with a headquarters and a prince's staff, and then subsequently there's an Adam and Eve, we're supposed to still have an Adam and Eve, alive on this world, and with various regional headquarters and whatnot. It's supposed to be a very different world. We understand that. So the Melchizedek receivers, except for that, roughly 100 years that Adam and Eve were here before they defaulted. Right? They were from 200,000 years ago until Mount Hermon, were basically guiding the planet. Let's remind ourselves, even before that, before the planetary prince arrived 500,000 years ago, there were 12 Melchizedeks here called the Melchizedek Observers. I thought it'd be fun to just go back and read that paragraph. You don't have to go back to it, but it's in the Over Control of Evolution paper. I'll just read you that to remind you about them. On an ordinary inhabited world, a planetary prince would have been granted on the request of the life carriers at or sometime after the appearance of Andon and Fonta, once you have will creatures. Shortly thereafter, you have a planetary prince, like I just said. But Urantia, having been designated a life modification planet, remember we're a decimal world, it was by prearrangement that the Melchizedek observers, 12 in number, were sent as advisors to the life carriers and as overseers of the planet until the subsequent arrival of the planetary prince. The 500,000 years, basically, you had those Melchizedek observers before the planetary prince arrived. These Melchizedeks came at the time Anda and Infanta made the decisions which enabled thought adjusters to indwell their mortal minds. You know, so, and we're reminded of, how Adam, the first will creatures are kind of a special pair. They definitely get a thought adjusters, right away, so that, their children will more naturally possibly have thought adjusters. And so those decisions, when they, at roughly age 11, when the seventh adjutant engaged them and they were encircled in the Holy Spirit and they got personalities, right, very shortly thereafter, as soon as the adjusters went through registration on Uversa, right, they arrived and those Melchizedeks were, observers were there to, take over the world. Because there's a limit, remember, to how much the life carriers can be hands-on. They're supposed to be kind of backed off, quite a bit once you have will creatures. So there's an example. See, no rebellion, no default, but it's an unusual situation that doesn't happen on normal worlds. You don't have a pre-Sangic race, right? But this world you did, so... there's going to be hundreds of thousands of years. They knew in advance, before there would be a planetary prince. So someone needed to step into that role. So there's a job for the Melchizedeks. Okay. So like they said, exceedingly active on this planet. So it's not surprising that... we would have some historical record, of someone like this. We obviously have no record of the Melchizedek observers or the fact that there were 12 Melchizedek receivers or anything. But there is a name that they could use directly to refer to these beings. It's right there in the Old Testament. It's like we've talked about. The book can't tell you there's secondary midwayers that are very, engaged with physical activity. There can't be beings like that and us having no historical record of that, right, or even present record of that fact. Right? There has to be something that you can point to. Right? And if there isn't, the book is garbage. Right? Someone just made it up. Right? There has to be. So, not surprisingly, for them being around for all those hundreds of thousands of years, the Melchizedeks, we have record of one. All right, so let's look at that incarnation and talk a little bit about, this very unique, relatively unique thing that they did here. Again, the exceedingly active in a way they're almost never active. They were active here. What is that about?
Section 1, the Machaventa incarnation. Revealed truth was threatened with extinction during the millenniums which followed the miscarriage of the Adamic mission on Urantia. Though making progress intellectually, the human races were slowly losing ground spiritually. About 3000 BC, the concept of God had grown very hazy in the minds of men.
Okay, so evolution continues on. There's there's intellectual evolution, as well as the minor measures of final physical evolution that are going on, but our minds identifying with spirit is extremely dependent on choice, and that choice needs to be fostered. Okay, and it's not being overtly fostered like it should have been for a very, very long time. So more and more we're interested in our navels rather than reaching up, and identifying with spirit. And so by 5,000 years ago, by 3,000 BC, navel lint was the most important thing on the planet, not God.
It just became lint.
Okay, it was just that's what they're and as they're point about to mention, remember ever since Adam and Eve, the Melchizedeks know that Michael has selected this world for his seventh bestowal, and they know it can't be too far in the future. And, you know, they know he's coming to be as much of a spiritual uplifter as he can, but you can't uplift nothing. And they're looking at it, and it's like, okay, it's going to zero. Okay, it doesn't matter if he's Michael of Nebadon incarnate, you know, I mean, you know, he's not magical. He can't uplift zero. All right? And so they're trying to figure out, oh, we've got to do something so that there's some measure of spiritual, you know, engagement, choice of engagement of human minds happening on this planet that he can uplift, that he can foster to higher heights. So what are they going to do, they're saying to themselves. All right, so, you know, just, you know, don't ever forget that it doesn't matter if we have, you know, that we now are post-Pentecost and we have the Spirit of Truth and universal bestowal of thought adjusters and all this groovy stuff. Spirit is still fundamentally a choice, right? And the revelators tell you it's sad to record. And there's almost no one on the planet that's doing anything. So the thought adjuster and the Spirit of Truth are just sitting there twiddling their thumbs. Right? It can easily grow hazy in your mind as well.
Right? Is the Spirit of Truth on Earth at that time? I thought it just came after Pentecost.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Even now. Right, we have the Spirit of Truth. We have all, you know, technically there's all this spiritual potential for you to take a hold of and utilize, but if you don't choose to take a hold of it, if you're much more interested in just outer life material issues, right, the latest political outrage or whatever, okay, I mean, the Spirit of Truth and Thought Adjuster are just sitting there twiddling their thumbs, waiting for you to do something significant, to have a reflective life. And of course, that's, you know, we have this emergency situation now, right? There's been a second emergency epical revelation, the one that's in my lap, right? Machaventa was the first, and this is the second, because, again, we're not choosing like we should be, and it's a situation where we need to be given a potentialization again. I mean, Machaventa can't lead the world forward by their nose ring, but he can inject some potential into the system, and those who have ears to hear can hear. And again, you got it here. This book isn't going to lead the world forward by its nose ring, but for those who have ears to hear, you can completely erase everything you've ever thought and start anew with something true. Right? And don't have to live in the old ghost cult frames or magical scientific theories that we've got right now. Okay. Remember, he's kind of going to come about 2000 BC, so 1,000 years in advance, right? Their gears are turning, and they're starting to plan. What are we going to do?
The 12 Melchizedek receivers knew of Michael's impending bestowal on their planet, but they did not know how soon it would occur. Therefore, they convened in solemn council and petition the Most Highs of Edentia that some provision be made for maintaining the light of truth on Urantia. This plea was dismissed with the mandate that, quote, the conduct of affairs on 606 of Satania is fully in the hands of the Melchizedek custodians. The receivers then appealed to the Father Melchizedek for help, but only received word that they should continue to uphold truth in the manner of their own election, quote, until the arrival of a bestowal son who would rescue the planetary titles from forfeiture and uncertainty.
See, there's that change of titular, planetary titles.
They weren't very helpful.
Yeah, well, in other words, well, and of course, no, but you should really, you know, there's a very important thing to recognize, the fact that you feel like saying that is important to take a hold of, right? Because nothing's changed, right? We can cry for all sorts of fancy, you know, intervention, you know, take a hold of us and just, you know, make us into light and life. It's like, no, that's not going to happen. It's an evolutionary universe, right? And that's what they're basically telling him. Guys, no, if there's some sort of micromanagement to that degree from way on high, like us, the Most Highs you just appealed to, we would be in rebellion. This is an evolutionary domain. We put you in the trenches. Do what you think, you know. Free will is respected. Melchizedek's free will is going to play into the system in a way that it normally doesn't play into a world. Right? Normally, their free will doesn't impact a world like it's impacted ours.
In a way, that's very empowering for us, I think.
Yeah.
I think that helps us to recognize that we have potential to actually, we could do something.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they would, you know, if we couldn't, then they would.
Then they would do it for
us,
right.
Or help us. Right. But because they're not, that means that we could.
That means do we, something. Yeah, we can do something, right? I mean, you have personality, not only with three finite dimensions, but three absolute dimensions, one absolute dimension. And then you have an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, which is a supreme thread of objectivity, of insight that you're just given initially by grace. Then you have the Spirit of Truth. Then you have the Thought Adjuster, a fragment of infinity. And seriously, what more do you need? Not to mention, there's all kinds of angels, not just guardian angels. There's all kinds of angels that are doing all kinds of things, helping in the background and stuff too. You have infinite help, inside and outside. Right? Tell your indolent animal nature, get off of its butt. And do something. Right? Do something real. Don't do something self-assertion. It's like, well, I'm going to make the world in my image. No, not like that. With full humility, see if you can recognize the nature, you know, of the cosmic system that you live in, and see if in your own little way, so as a lowly little blob of protoplasm, if you can do a little something to help out, like the Melchizedek's help out, to foster, you know, genuine progress, not rebellion progress, not change without growth, right? You know, you're going to take a hold of that impatient spiritual consciousness that you have, and you're going to erase that "when do we want it now" part. Right? No, everything has its time, and you don't dictate it, you know, with your impatience that time is now. Okay, you know, you get yourself synchronized with the wholeness, with the kairos of reality, with how everything has its time and place, and humbly see if you can coordinate yourself with that and foster that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm struck by, they may have guessed beforehand that it was going to end up in their hands.
Yeah.
But they still went through the steps of appealing to higher authority.
Yeah. Yeah. You know that they don't want to be in rebellion, right? They're not going to presume. They know there's a vast, you know, hierarchical, you know, bureaucracy. If you take the negative out of our word bureaucracy, but there is, right? There's a whole administrative regime, right? And you know, things are recorded in triplicate, you know, physical, moral, and spiritual triplicate, and what have you, right? I mean, we know this whole administrative regime, they're very respectful of that. They're not going to presume, right? You know, they're definitely not going to say, "You're not the boss of me." No, like they mentioned, who do they appeal to first? Right? Because of the rebellion, the Most Highs took charge of the rebellion worlds, right? They're the boss. Okay? You know, and if there's a, you know, a very poignant, you know, definitive emergency, the Veronidic observer that's, you know, there with the Melchizedeks and is still here now will assume regency, you know, and he exercises absolute authority when he does that. It's as if the Universal Father himself is standing here. You know, everyone just says, yes, sir, okay, to his, you know, commands. But that's an exception. Only those Veronidics that know very precisely how to insert themselves so definitively and not be in rebellion can do something like that. Everyone else is like, well, I have this idea. What do you think of that? Okay, no, not that. Okay, you know, everyone else needs to be respectful of the whole hierarchy, put it up the chain of command, et cetera. Yeah.
What kind of circumstance would bring the Veronidic to
intervene? We don't know.
We just, if we were going to destroy ourselves?
Well, it's it would be the Veronidics rule in the kingdoms of men. I mean, they, you know, so it's not the things that we might think are an emergency. It's the things that are really, really an emergency. Something that, you know, unless they intervene, even with all of the incredible potential of long spans of time with the evolutionary process to work around difficulties and eventually get you there, there's no way the planet can get to light and life unless they poke their finger in and do something definitive. They know what that is. And if there is something like that, and they tell you there's a handful of times that over the last 200,000 years that they've had to do that, you know, it's it doesn't matter what humans want or don't want. You know, whatever needs to happen will happen. You know, you just have to always be aware of that, you know, that there's always a possibility of them doing something that, you know, every human on the planet might think that's the worst thing that could ever happen. That's because we have such limited foresight, right? They see the big picture, you know. They know that this thing happening right now, even if it causes lots of pain and suffering for a short period of time, is what needs to happen in order to keep things moving forward. You know, like we always point out, I mean, since the Veronidic observer intervenes, you know, for, you know, what's best for the most people for the longest period of time, you know, it just goes without saying, it's going to be a little problematic for a handful of people for a short period of time. Right? Don't be surprised if people die. You know, it when they intervene, you know, it's prickly.
It's what?
Prickly. Oh. It's, you know, it's not sunshine and lollipops. If you were to try to figure out when in the past, you know, if any time in recorded history they've done it, you know, it might be. Don't look for some point when all of a sudden everyone is singing Kumbaya, right? That's probably not one of their times. It's probably a time when things are very, very intense, because there's something needs, you know, the gears are grinding because they need to really turn it hard, and the human system with its inertia is not liking it, right? It's fighting it.
Plus, we can't see that it was due to them.
Yeah, and we won't, yeah. It's not like there's going to be some guy with a magic wand, you know, that's recorded in history. they work very definitively, but in a way where, you know, we're all just going to think, well, that's just the way it rolled out. You know, there was this guy and he did this and that. And it's, you know, that guy was just a human. It wasn't a Veronidic masquerading as a human or something. You know, it's just, you know, like we've pointed out, you know, if they needed a vote, you know, they remove kings and set up kings, quote unquote, right? They tell you that's literal. You know, if they need to do that. If the vote needs to go a certain way, it doesn't matter. Coincidentally, when you count the votes, it comes out the way they want it to come out. Right? They can just do, you know, they can make it happen. You know, we'll all think everything just, well, boy, wasn't expecting that, but that's the way the vote, we counted them, that's the count. Right? I mean, But that, you know, they're able to do whatever to make it, you know, what it needs to be. You know, and just knowing that they rule, the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men, should give you peace. You know, we can all, you know, pour a cup of water on our hair that's on fire, right? It's okay. You know, everyone gets all panicky about, you know, political issues and what's going on. It's like, no, the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. If there's something really existentially problematic, there's nothing to worry about. They'll deal with it. Right? No real harm can befall the world. Right? There's no nuclear weapons or chemical pollutions or climate change or anything that can really hurt the world. Right? If something really physical needs to be done, yeah, or me, you know, any of us. I mean, yeah, and there's no real harm can befall me either because I'm absolutely sovereign where it counts. Yeah, I mean, you know, remember with, you know, big global physical sorts of things that we could worry about. I mean, you've got all these master physical controllers on the planet. You have 10 mechanical controllers on this planet. Each of them is a being that can rearrange the galaxy.
Oh my God.
Okay?
Each one.
I mean, do you think, you know, nuclear waste is probably not a big issue? I mean, you know, like I've tried to point out, I mean, those beings, all they would have to do is just think it, and instantly this entire planet would turn into a giant daisy. they can engage it at the ultimate atomic level.
They don't do that.
They're not going to do that. But they could. I mean, that's the kind of power that's resident here. Okay.
Away from them.
Okay. Nothing's going to get away from them. Okay. All right. All they'd have to do is think it, and they would rearrange the continents, and you know. Okay. I mean, we can all take a deep breath. No real harm is going to befall the world. See if, with some humility, you can do some little part that a little blob of protoplasm can do in a short lifespan. Do a little something and do it based upon trust instead of on panic. Think of all the people that are acting out of panic. By definition, nothing that they do is going to really help.
They're more anxiety out of panic than acting.
Yeah. The only way there's any possibility that ignorant little beings like us could possibly do something that would really help is if we start with sublime trust in the integrity of the system, right? And like Jesus said, you know, seek first that kingdom of heaven. Go back, throw out all of your fancy notions, go back to that fundamental objective consciousness that you were given as a child at roughly age 6. Refound yourself in some calm objectivity. Use some common sense, some basic insight. Right? No. If you're panicky, common sense goes out the window. Your connection to the cosmos goes out the window. Right? So there's no way you're going to be really helping.
But there is a way you can really help.
Yeah.
Love one another.
Yeah.
That's really yeah. a real way you can help.
Yeah, and again, and just to challenge that word love up like that. You know, don't be sentimental with one another. That's not going to help. No, really love one another. Okay? Right? Love is purely an inner life fact. Right? It's not about rearranging molecules, right? Based upon feelings. My feelings tells me I want to rearrange these molecules. No, that's not love. You know, that's just sentiment. Figure out what genuine love is, you know, and then have that be a predicate for how you engage your fellow man. Right? I mean, you know, the fact that we so don't know what love is, that's why Jesus tried to challenge us. You know, and didn't say, love your best friend. What did he say? He said, love your enemy. And you go, well, I can't be positively sentimental for my enemy. Yeah, that's because what I'm talking about is not sentiment. It's not a feeling. I'm not telling you to have feelings for someone. I'm telling you to love someone. So until you can go up high enough that you can transcend feelings, you can't get to love. You can't get to whatever this is he's talking about that you do for an enemy. Right? So, you know, that's a place to start, is pick the person on the planet that you detest the most. and try to think about what, how you could direct your nature in their direction in a way that isn't negative. And maybe you're moving up above your feelings, which are going to be innately negative, up to this level of love. Right? You know that people don't know what the word love means, and their sign says, you know, love not hate, and their face is purple. Right? They don't have any idea what those four letters mean, that L-O-V-E is. Right? All they know is hate. Their face, you know, by your face I know you. Love doesn't produce a purple face. Doesn't produce screaming, right? And threats. Right? What is love? You had a question?
I was just thinking, even if, you know, love thy neighbor, this whole concept, and you go beyond just peace studies, that individually in our own brain, that whole process is going to make us have a very open mind.
Yeah.
Because it's not natural to love somebody.
You got
to
open up and go up, yes.
Completely want to avoid. Right. So, and then that way we can really understand all different types of people or beings or archangels or whatever spherical universe you want to talk about. But we can really understand something besides ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think that might be the gateway to love.
It is.
The tapestry, yeah.
It literally is. I won't. Yeah, I mean, people know this, but I'll just, you know, you haven't heard this before. But you can you know, get into the physics of moving up the levels of meaning to the level of love, and on the way up there, when you're getting close, there's a level of what you could call brotherly love. It isn't full on love yet. It's getting close. So, you know, you can call it kind of a flavor of love. What it technically is kindness. Brotherly love is kindness. That's what you're doing with your neighbor, right? That kind of brotherly love with your neighbor. That's technically kindness. What does kind mean? It means kin. Kindness is kin-likeness, right? It's where you treat as if they're your family, right? I mean, obviously, there's no way you're going to get to this very transcendent, genuine love if you can't get to the family level of relationship first, right? If you can't get to the level where you're kind to someone, where you're kin-like to them, where you know, the arrows now are pointed out. It's not like fairness where the arrows are pointed in. You go, well, okay, I'll let the arrow point at you, but okay, you gotta let it point at me here after a little while, because that's only fair, right? Right? The arrows are pointed in down there on fairness. Get up to kindness, the arrows are pointed out. It's like, okay, I'll point the arrow at you. I'll sacrifice for you. It's a level of mutual self-sacrifice. Mutual. But there's a responsibility. You need to be willing to reciprocate and sacrifice for me. That's what family does. Right? The arrows are pointed out, and you share the arrows. But what if you go up another notch and you'll just point the arrow at someone else? But you don't have any need for it to reciprocate. What if you transcend kindness?
That's kind of what you do with your own children.
Right.
That's why you have to experience
right.
that.
Right. You go up to the level of mercy, right? The level of selflessness. And you'll just point the arrow at someone because it needs to be pointed at them. And it doesn't matter if they reciprocate one iota. Now you're getting really close. Now it's just one more notch up to love. And if you can figure out how to take that additional step. But see, most people think that love is a feeling. That's on the on the second level. That's four levels short of genuine love. Where love is a feeling, affection. Where love is affection. You know, that the word love means affection, merely affection. Yeah. And of course, for some, it's not even that. It's on the down on the first level of meaning, on the level of the flesh. Right? We use the word love for as a synonym for sex. For Pete's sake, right? You know, when you say God is love, you probably don't mean God is sexual intercourse. It's probably not what you mean by the expression, right? I mean, you got to take this up a long ways, right? And you need to recognize that basically humans don't know what L-O-V-E means. It's being revealed to us. We're being encouraged to reach up and recognize it, Right? Jesus was doing the same thing. He's saying, okay, I'm trying to get you to recognize brotherly love, the level of kindness, but I would lead you up two notches to what I'm going to call fatherly love, genuine love, which is, if you transcend selflessness, it's like, well, how can I go any higher than that? I'm selfless. Isn't that as high as I can go?
Yeah.
No, there's one more notch. See, because this selfless state you're in, I still have to use the word self to describe it. If I go up another notch, the word self has got to disappear. What's transcendent of selflessness? Godlikeness. Fatherly love. Right? To get up to that level, that's what you're trying to do. Right? Where the self is so not involved that you don't even describe your state as selfless. So you have to be thinking about yourself to say you're selfless. What if you're not thinking about yourself at all? Okay. What if you're engaging someone in a godlike fashion? What's that like? How far is that above the difference between selves and whether that self is pleasant to you or not? See, you've just gone way beyond that. You've completely transcended that. Okay. Meanwhile, back to Machiavelli and Melchizedek. So we have the Melchizedek receivers first appealing to the bosses, right, on this rebellion world, the Most Highs, and they say, nope, it's in your hands. They say, well, what a Father Melchizedek, like I told you, the head of the Melchizedek order up there with Gabriel. He says, nope, you got it, boys. Okay. So they chew on it for 1,000 years and come up with a plan. Another reason to be patient. Even when the beings, celestial beings, are going to help you, don't expect it to be tomorrow. Things have to be planned out. When you've been alive for billions and billions and tens of billions of years, 1,000 years is a pretty short span. So what do they decide to do here?
And it was in consequence of having been thrown so completely on their own resources that Machiaventa Melchizedek, one of the 12 planetary receivers, volunteered to do that which had been done only 6 times in all the history of Nebadon, to personalize on Earth as a temporary man of the realm, to bestow himself as an emergency son of world ministry. Permission was granted for this adventure by the Salvington authorities, and the actual incarnation of Machiaventa Melchizedek was consummated near what was to become the city of Salem in Palestine. The entire transaction of the materialization of this Melchizedek son was completed by the planetary receivers with the cooperation of the life carriers, certain of the master physical controllers, and other celestial personalities resident on Urantia.
Okay, so one step at a time here. So they decide that this sort of subtly playing behind, with fostering the planet behind the scenes, they've been doing that for a long time and it wasn't working. They were going to need to really step into play. Someone is going to have to go down into the trenches and work it directly. So Machiaventa, out of the 12 volunteers, and you notice here's our plan. They sent it up the chain of command, right, and made sure, because again, like I said, they don't want to be in rebellion. They want to make sure they're not, stepping out of their place here. Because like they point out, and they mentioned this back with the Melchizedeks, right? This has only happened 7 times, or like here, it's only happened 6 times prior. In other words, it hasn't happened since either, in the last 4,000 years, anywhere in the local universe of Nebadon. So, So this is an exceptional thing. It's like, okay, well, you think we need to do this very exceptional thing. Is that okay? And comes back, goes all the way up to Salvington. Yep, that's fine. Go ahead with it. Yep.
Interment and adventure.
Yes. Right. Because, you know, they are going to be put out of their comfort zone here. Right. You know, this things are going to come into play that normally don't come into play, right? This is an adventure. Everyone takes a deep breath, finds their courage, and pushes it outside of the comfort zone. Was there a question? Oh, yeah.
Is this the idea of a New Jerusalem? Is that this idea, or is it Protestant theory?
this is... We'll see the relationship to Jerusalem here shortly, but the New Jerusalem thing in Revelation, that that's not directly in play here. They do play off of that term and coin a name, a New Jerusalem word, Gerasim, that they use in the book, because they needed a name for the local system headquarters. There we have, right now we have 619 inhabited worlds in our local system. This is not just our solar system, obviously. This is the immediate region of space that we live in, of the galaxy. And there's a headquarters world for that, that they needed to coin an English name for. And so they coined New Jerusalem. They kind of just played with the letters and coined Gerasim. And the reason they did that is there have been people in the past that have had visualizations of that, been given a visualization of it. That when people have had a vision of this New Jerusalem, this fancy thing, they might have thought it was brought down here, but really they weren't visualizing the future here, which the person might have thought was happening. They were getting a vision of what was up there. And so,
heavenly vision.
Yeah, quote unquote heavenly vision, right? And I won't go into the physics of how that happens, but the revelators, okay, that's great. So the fact that people have called that New Jerusalem, let's just use that for the name of this place that they were actually visualizing, this headquarters world. Okay, but here we're just talking about Palestine, and how it, we'll read that in the next section here about how it starts with Salem and then finally ends up as Jerusalem. So what else do we have here? Let's see. So they're going to do this for the seventh time. Permission was granted. And this is going to involve all kinds of, like we've talked about before, lots of technology here, as you can tell. See, I mean, he's not just going to morph his body into a physical manifestation. Okay, they're literally going to build a body, and he's going to incarnate into it. All right. So just like they build the 100 bodies for the prince's staff 500,000 years ago, right? Very much like that. They're building a body with every cell, every stitch of plumbing, the whole thing. Right? They're building a body, and he is going to synchronize his energy nature with the energy nature of that body. So it's not an incarnation like Michael did, Michael of Nebadon is syncing up with a single-celled conception in Mary's womb, okay, and then the thing is maturing. Okay, they're building a full, mature adult male body, and so just like the prince's staff. And then, but instead of having like those staff members that are Marantia energy body that synchronized with that physical body that was built, he has this higher, more spirit energy like body that he synchronizes with it. But this aren't, as they'll tell you, remember, this is a literal material body that has adjutant mind then, just like we do, right? And circuit, you know, and then encircuitment of the Holy Spirit and all that. He's synchronizing with all that. There's going to be a thought adjuster. There's going to be a soul. And so when all is said and done, that Maranatha soul, see, fuses with his former Melchizedek nature. And he's not a Melchizedek technically anymore. See, he's this modified being. Just like Michael is not a pure creator son anymore. Because there's a soul, you know, that is infused into his being now. It's one of the reasons why you call him a master son now instead of a creator son. There's deity reasons as well. But you know, this is a modified being now. You know, you're going to still call him a Melchizedek, but he isn't technically merely a Melchizedek. Right? He's a super additive consequence of the relationship between a Melchizedek and a soul, a mortal soul. Okay? Didn't fuse with his adjuster, right?
No.
But... but he definitely, the soul infused him. Yeah, the adjuster has other things to do. Yep.
Does he resemble the people around him?
Yeah, oh, yeah. That's in the next section here. Yes, he did.
Do you know would they be blonde?
We'll see in a second here. We'll see in a second.
I have an idea.
Let's just see what we can speculate from what they tell you here. Tell us here shortly. But you know, just like I said, it's going to involve life carriers, obviously. You know, and you're going to need master physical controllers to manipulate. You know, stuff and build, you know, help build the body. So all those beings are in play, you know, plus beings they probably aren't even revealed in the fifth epical revelation are involved. These other celestial personalities resident here, you know. But it takes a whole team of beings, you know, and they have to have literal material hardware, you know. So somewhere near what's now Jerusalem, right, they set up a little lab. You know, and to make sure that, you know, no one could see what was going on. I mean, they got a high-tech lab set up, just like they had to set up a high-tech lab to make, you know, to rematerialize Adam and Eve or to make the prince's staff's bodies. Right? Okay.
I think the Avalon surgeons got involved.
No, it doesn't seem like, you know.
Wouldn't it be cool if we discovered some place like that? Really, that would be cool.
But yeah, think about it very literally. Okay, there's nothing magic. You know, no one's waving a magic wand. Okay, they've got literal technology, hardware, a lab.
They probably destroyed the evidence.
You would think that they probably either that or it's stashed away in the Midwayers archive somewhere.
It's very shiny and new.
But anyway, let's see what they tell us here in the next section.
Section 2, The Sage of Salem. It was 1,973 years before the birth of Jesus that Machaventa was bestowed upon the human races of Urantia. His coming was unspectacular. His materialization was not witnessed by human eyes. He was first observed by mortal man on that eventful day when he entered the tent of Amdon, a Chaldean herder of Sumerian extraction. And the proclamation of his mission was embodied in the simple statement which he made to this shepherd, quote, "I am Melchizedek, priest of El Elyon, the Most High, the one and only God."
Okay, so here he is, calling him the Sage of Salem. Remember, you have that triplet of wisdom, insight, foresight. And if you want to be more succinct, you can say wisdom and sagacity. Sagacity is a term that encompasses both insight and foresight. So when you call someone a sage, you mean it's someone that has very definitive, objective consciousness, insight, and foresight. Obviously, there's wisdom too, right? But you know, you're focusing on that. That objectivity and that insight and foresight, so that they can learn by looking and not just by leaping. And they can tell someone, "No, don't leap." You know, for instance, that's a sage. Okay, and so just like we were saying, it's all done out of sight. And so it's just, you know, one day, you know, coming across the plane or whatever, because this guy, and he opens the tent door and says, "Hello." You know, not surprisingly, he would engage someone of Sumerian extraction. So, in other words, someone that has a little bit better genetics, you know, sort of the residual measures of the Andites, you know, from southern Mesopotamia that were close at hand there. You know, of course, you know, this is not in the Bible, you know, this incident, but so they're giving you this. And but right away, like we talked about when we were talking about the epical revelations, since he's not a dispensational epical revelation that he's launching here, he's launching an epical revelation, but not a dispensational one. He's fundamentally, you know, by and large, not going to move things to the next notch. He's going to stay in that Adam and Eve sort of mode of how to talk about the universe and God, you know, the sort of the constellation level, the Most High sort of level. So that's how he speaks about God as the Most High. And El Elyon, you know, literally means God, El, Most High, Elyon. You know, and he's definitely right up front fostering monotheism, right? That move to monotheism, the one and only God. So that's his opening salvo. Doesn't just say hello. He gets into teaching, you know, in an encouraging upward manner in the very first sentence. What does he do next?
When the herder had recovered from his astonishment, and after he had plied this stranger with many questions, he asked Melchizedek to sup with him. And this was the first time in his long universe career that Machaventa had partaken of material food, the nourishment which was to sustain him throughout his 94 years of life as a material being.
Okay, so right up front they tell you he's gonna hang out for 94 years. You know, he's basically not going to age, you know, over that time. This is a very, very solid genetics he's got going here, you know. So it's going to be kind of like the prince and his staff or Adam and Eve or the first generation of Adam and Eve's children sort of thing where they, you know, he would have an extremely long lifespan if he had lived all the way until he, you know, experienced mortal death.
Hope he gave him something he liked.
Yeah, and you're immediately wondering, it's like, whoa, the very first taste of food, you know, what was it, you know?
I didn't know who you were, but I thought you might be able to give me dinner.
But the thing, you know, the interesting thing between the lines, like we're talking about, you know that this Melchizedek, you know, has probably many, many times functioned in some mode or he was manifesting physically. Yeah. But this is the first time he's eaten. So, see, they're telling you something there. That even when they're in that mode, like when they're serving as a, you know, Melchizedek life carrier, okay, they're still getting you know, energy directly from the master physical controllers, you know, quote unquote, from the environment, as it were. You know, they're not having to eat just because they morph so they look like me and have a mouth and a stomach and, you know, intestines and whatnot. So it's only, you know, this material body that was built needs to have that physical nourishment. In other words, they didn't build a body that would require having the fruit of the tree of life, because, of course, we don't have the tree of life, right? Or something else that would kind of just receive its energy directly from the environment through from the master physical controllers. They just build a regular material body like we understand that we have that has to put stuff in the hole in your face, you know, and you know, and metabolize it, and you know, in your stomach intestines. You know, he's just literally like us. It's an incarnation.
If you weren't going on a diet again, think of what you just said.
Right.
But you said he
doesn't
age.
Well, no, he's aging. It's so slight, you know, that after 94 years, he would still look basically the same. I mean, you know, you take like, you know, remember Adamson, you know, he's 120 years old and he probably still looked like he was 20, right? You know, those, you know, when you've got that, you know, such, you know, near perfect genetics like that, you know, you have a lifespan of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Okay, and so, you know, he's being, obviously they're making a body and it's prime for him. You know, he's a virile young man. right? And you know, and so, you know, he's not going to really change much at all over those 94 years.
So why did they build a body instead of having him morph directly into it?
That's, see, an unanswered question. See, that's sort of just between the lines here. Right? You're going, well, why not just have him manifest? And see, it really gets you thinking about, you know, even an epical revelation is evolutional. Like we talked about so much, you know, this book is evolution. It's not evolutionary, but it's evolutional. It's designed to match up, you know, and meet the evolutionary system where it is. And the only way he can do that, I mean, if he just morphed with his Melchizedek mindedness and whatnot, you know, which is not even adjutant mind and whatnot, and manifest that way, it would be a non sequitur. Yeah. Right? It wouldn't mesh in. So he has to meet us as we are, right? With our kind of mind, so that it matches up as closely as possible.
You could even wonder, would he even be as nearly as effective if he was that?
Yeah. I mean, he couldn't have talked to anyone in a way that would seem natural to us, you know, with his, you know, non-adjutant mind, it would just strike us as weird, and
we couldn't relate to him. Right. You know, people, when there's knowledge transfer, you want to be able to help people, you know, relate to what's being transferred. You know, something, you know, it's something like this, and you know, and how would the Melchizedek understand what would be understandable?
Yeah.
He wouldn't have that insight.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. See, it works both ways. See, it's not just for our benefit, but for his as well. I mean, why did Michael incarnate, you know, and go through the whole process? Because, you know, he's not going to, you know, pretend he's a human. Okay, you can't learn anything by pretending. You have to really be. Right? He was true man. Machiavelli needs to be true man. He needs to, one of the things they're probably talking about is like, well, maybe the reason we're not being effective is we're all kind of so heavenly minded, we're no earthly good. Maybe we Melchizedek's, one of us needs to be a little bit more grounded so we really can kind of get it and meet them more where they are. Maybe we're kind of, you know, doing this, you know, the humans are down here and we're just kind of playing above them. Maybe one of us needs to really get down and really understand how they think more directly, right?
And he was able to get over his astonishment. A full-blown Melchizedek probably wouldn't have got over that.
Yeah, it just would have been weird, yeah. I'm sure it just would have been weird. Especially, you know, the more or the longer he stayed, you know, he would just strike people as weirder and weirder and weirder, you know, the longer he went on, you know, as this non sequitur. So he's right there. He meets us where we are, as we are, can relate to us, we can relate to him, and there's a solid potential for an interplay here of consequence. All right. Anything else there? Oh, just remember, long universe career. That's long, remember, right? Very, very long, right? You know, vastly longer than current scientists think there's been a universe, right? Right. Remember when they start the story of our local region of the galaxy, they start a trillion years ago, right?
And we're young.
Yeah, and that's extremely young. Okay. You know, current scientists think it's, you know, 13 point whatever, you know, billion. It's like, no.
Why would he suddenly ply him with so many questions? Like, what would he...
Just the reason would be, you know, as you read those words, they even kind of sound it, but he, I'm sure he said it even more so. The authority. I try to always do that when I say, "Hello, my name is Machaventa Melchizedek, and I'm the ruler of this world." He would speak with unbelievable authority when he said that, and we would all just be, "Whoa." Yeah, remember how even Jesus as a young man, as a third circler, right, could speak in a way where Caesar listened to him and was like, "Whoa, now if I was like that guy, I'd be a king, eh?" Right, he would have had a commanding presence. You're about to see he had a commanding physical visage and presence and a commanding voice. He spoke, you know, with absolute authority, you know, and it's like, "Whoa, I've got all kinds of questions for you." Because remember, they were much more open. You know, they believed in people being prophets and being engaged and, you know, lots of things. And, you know, he was obviously a holy man. And if you meet a holy man, you want to ask him questions. And then you believe that he has answers. You don't just think he's a nut job like we do today. Right?
So this was after Abraham.
No, this is, you know, Melchizedek's going to engage Abraham here, you know, once he gets going. Yep. Yep. But this is, you know, this is immediately prior to Abraham being on the scene that he's, you know, coming into this tent here.
Well, it's interesting that Melchizedek needed to do this because they could have fostered a prophet, like, you know, in all the other situations. I mean, a prophet could have said the exact same thing.
Yep.
But that wouldn't have been enough.
But that reminds you, we talked about that some, right? I mean, prophet isn't some perfect conduit thing. I mean, you get all the warts and everything of some guy. I mean, you know, there are genuine prophets, someone who's being engaged by celestial beings in some way and tweaked and whatnot. But, you know, what that tweaking immediately is immersed in the sea of confusion and ignorance and whatnot of that individual, and so you get, you know, all of the detritus along with a couple of decent thoughts. Okay, no, he wants to give full fire hose purity message for 94 years, you know, not just some little swizzle stick for 5 minutes. Okay, so, you know, a prophet is not going to do it.
You know,
remember, it's the same way with, you know, getting a book like this. You can't do any sort of a normal thing. I mean, you need 2,000 pages of perfect integrity, right? Where, you know, you have to do that very directly, right? You're not going to get that through someone, you know. They're going to muddle it all up. Right? I mean, the adjuster is inside of our mind and has lots and lots of experience, you know, and tries to gently give you one little thing, and you grab a hold of it and turn it into a grotesque, you know, object, right? Because you've got your whole worldview that you assimilate that into, and your worldview is completely false. And so his little nugget of truth is falsified as soon as you ingest it into your mind. It's the same way, you know, with anything. So, yeah, they needed to get something solid.
How can we be guided then by the adjuster and the spirit of truth if we immediately falsify it?
That like they tell you initially, just recognize that. Let them guide you superconsciously, above your conscious. Let them work on forming kind of a context for your conscious mind. You know, and slowly, unconsciously, there'll be an improved frame for your conscious mind. And, you know, you won't be aware of it, but over time, you'll just, your conscious mind will be working better. And you might start to wonder, like, you know, 20 years ago, I didn't handle things as well as I do now. It's almost like I have a better mental frame that I think in. Yeah. That's how it begins. You know, as you mature, you're able to become more and more consciously in interplay with this without messing it up. But initially, you're just a little child of God. And you need to let them kind of work back in the ceiling of your mind, you know, and slowly just give a better context for your consciousness. Allow you, you know, they're going to foster your growth so that you're not a child of God forever. You can start to go into adolescence and you can eventually be an adult of God.
Talk about being heavenly helpers, not earthly helpers.
Yes.
They're really working on, you can go on that a little bit, but they're really working on the future you more than you are now. And you get a little bit of it here. They also warn you to be somewhat cautious about thinking that you got to, you know, thinking about what you get is really directly from your thought adjuster. So as he said, it's more of a gradual thing that just sort of.
And something you approach very humbly, see?
It's unconscious in a way.
Yeah.
Is there a part of us that can guide us, though, like a wiser part of ourselves that can give us answers?
You can supply favorable conditions for this, definitely. Yeah, just work on being loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient. There's lots of other things. Start with those five. That's a handful. All right? Those things are things you can consciously do. I'm determined to be loyal. I'm determined to be humble. I'm determined to be sincere. Right? I'm determined to be just. In other words, honest and law-abiding. And I'm determined to be patient. I'm not going to paint a new what do I want, fill in the blank, when do I want it now sign every 5 minutes. I'm going to be patient. I'm going to trust. Right? If you do those things, that allows them to gently reframe your mind. But if you don't supply those favorable conditions, you're pushing yourself all the way to the boundaries, and they can't sneak around and reframe your mind.
When you say law by, you mean God's laws, right? Distorted laws.
I mean, Jesus, this is where it's problematic with Jesus. During his private ministry, before his public ministry, he was law-abiding. The mores of his culture said you can't paint things, so he didn't paint things.
Right.
Because he's a little kid to begin with, but eventually he matures and recognizes. So it's so easy to go to self-righteousness. It's like, well, that speed limit, that applies to the lesser people, not me. It's like, wow, wait, what am I saying? Lesser people?
Guidelines.
It's just even if you can recognize idealistically that there could be a better law, be careful. Like Jesus said, he said, okay, your religious leaders, they are really borderline iniquitous. But until the Most High removes them, you obey them.
Render to Caesar.
Right? Because the moment that you start thinking otherwise, you're thinking in revolutionary terms. And revolutionary terms is rebellion. You're joining the Lucifer Rebellion. We need to be humble. There's a mores system, or there's laws that we have now. Be fundamentally respectful of those. If you have a lot of interest in laws, well, then educate yourself and become a legislator and work in a legislature to alter laws. But don't just say, laws don't apply to me. I'm a transcendent being. See, you're being rebellious. Right? Jesus tried to warn us against that. Everyone is throughout all of human history has tried to warn us against that. They're the laws. If you don't have laws, you don't have order. You have anarchy.
It seems like a lot of the laws though breed disorder.
Yeah, well, but see, it's just like I was saying about the Most High's intervene, and it's like, well, they're not bringing order. This is all disorder. Yeah, well, you're looking at it in a short span of time. This temporary disorder will lead to greater order down the road. You have to be very cautious. It's a whole system. You change one thing to make it better, and if it's not integrated with the system, you'll actually make things worse. The laws are part of an evolutionary process. They aren't arbitrary like we think they are. You know, just because we were born just a few decades ago and it's like these laws just seem to have come out of the blue. No, there's a million years of evolution that led to certain laws, right? And you can't, you know, they need to grow forward. They can't be changed by fiat. That's revolution. So, right, it's, you know, if there's no way, you know, let me just give you one other sense about that just, that honest and law-abiding. There's a hierarchy to get up to love. And I was referring to just, fair, patient, kind, merciful, loving. And you'd like to get up to that love, but you can't do it if you're not first just. They tell you point blank. Everything, if you say, well, I don't have to be just, I just want to be loving. No, what you call love will be delusional. First just, next fair, then patient. Right? You need to build it up. That genuine love sits on a whole foundation.
So would it be wrong then to disobey the law? Like, for example, the country was going to war and you want to be a conscientious objector?
Well, I mean, there's a law for you to be a conscientious objector. See, we have some wisdom built into the laws. Right? There's an avenue if you're a conscientious objector.
Put them in jail too.
Yeah, again, there's all kinds of problems. I mean, again, I mean, we can't resolve all this right now, obviously. But because you just, like I said, fundamentally start with thinking law-abiding. Right? You may need to bring in exceptions, but don't start with no laws and add the ones you like. Start with all laws first, very humbly, and just say yes, sir, okay? And then work, right? It's like, well, here, I would like to work to see if I can foster some evolution of the laws in this area, because it feels like we need a little bit more enlightenment here, okay? But I'm not going to do that by starting with anarchy. You know, I need to start by being a law abiding and then foster its evolution. I need to respect the evolutionary process. That's fundamentally what Jesus was trying to teach. So we need to learn more. Okay, where were we? I've totally lost my place. Let's see. Okay, we've 94 years. Okay, and that night. Yep, okay.
And that night, as they talked out under the stars, Melchizedek began his mission of the revelation of the truth of the reality of God, when, with a sweep of his arm, he turned to Amnon, saying, quote, El Elyon, the Most High, is the divine creator of the stars of the firmament, and even of this very earth on which we live, and he is also the supreme God of heaven.
In other words, he needs to definitively, you know, encourage the concept of God as a creator, not just as the tribal special guy. Okay, but a creator being, and the creator of everything. You know, in this sense, quote unquote, the heavens and the earth, as you can see, right? So that's, you know, fostering that improvement of a God idea. God as the universal creator, and that continued to be fostered forward to the Hebrews, hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, thinking of less as a tribal god, like the volcano god Yahweh, and more as, you know, the universal creator. And then, of course, the supreme God of heaven. You know, to get him to be, not be the guy that is playing around here with dirt clods with you, right? He's the, quote-unquote, the sky father, if you will, right? He's above. And he's the aboveness of the above. He's the supreme God of heaven.
Chris, is this the El Elohim, the biblical God, El Elyon?
El Elyon, you know, is one of the many names in the Old Testament for God, and they're pointing out it stems from, you know, most immediately from Melchizedek using that name for God. You know, it's one of the many names. You know, El was the is the basic generic name in the Near East there for God. You know, and then there was, you know, modifications of that El Shaddai, El Elyon, you know, etc. And eventually, you know, you merged all of these various names, like Elohim or Eloah, you know, and El Elyon. You merged them all into a supreme Yahweh concept. By the time you get to Isaiah, right? They all get merged in with Yahweh, and Yahweh gets improved as you merge in these other better ideas. Because, you know, Yahweh initially was just literally the volcano god. Okay, and wasn't a creator of the heavens or anything like that. He was just that awesome, you know, fire-breathing thing there. Yep.
I'm trying to square the idea of Revelation 1 of the Most High,
mm-hmm.
constellation fathers, with the creator of heaven and earth.
Here's a good example, you know, of truth and fact.
It seems like way above the Most High.
See, and remember, we talked about that back when we were talking about those levels where you start with the local system and you go to constellation. I mean, you just, you know, you let it just be the truth of that. I mean, you know, the Most High isn't literally the universal creator, but you just kind of keep the universe small, sort of constellation-sized. For most people, you'll see, he doesn't do this with everyone, but for most people, you just kind of keep a more parochial sort of sized universe. And you just let the fatherness of the Most High be in truth, the fatherness of the Universal Father, you know, and if he's the father over that whole constellation-sized universe, well, you know, then he's effectively in truth the Universal Creator. Anyway, remember we talked about that. He doesn't let the complexity of the facts get in the way, because it's going to be too confusing for most people.
They didn't have telescopes. He just
lets it, you know. He trusts the evolutionary process, right? He's giving him something that there's truth flowing through it, even if it doesn't have infinite factual precision to it. It has truth flowing through it. The higher mind that he's speaking to will pick up that thread of truth and work with it.
Chris, one thing.
Yep.
I love talking out under the stars.
Mm-hmm.
It's been such a wonderful mm-hmm. experience when mm-hmm. it's happened.
Yeah.
And with him, it would be even better.
Yeah, and you know, he's sowing the seeds there. Remember, like we talked about, you know, literally, if you go out, you know, in a very dark area, you know, out in the country somewhere, you see the fullness of the sky with your naked eyes. I mean, basically everything you see in the sky is a star that's within just the local universe. And so this can be very direct. You know, you can tell someone, just, you know, look at all the stars above you. And that's the local universe of Nebadon. All right. Yeah, there's lots and lots beyond that, right? But you know, that what you see with your naked eye is essentially the scale of a local universe. You know, and that's why they call these subunits of the local universe constellations, because we break the firmament of the heavens, we break the celestial sphere, you know, into these regions that we call constellations. So they work as subunits of the whole thing. Constellations are subunits of a local universe. That's why they call them constellations. Right, that's all just English, you know, naming of these things for our sake, something we can relate to. You know, and it's roughly the same division. You have 100 constellations in a local universe. That's, you know, roughly the order of magnitude, the way we break, you know, the celestial sphere into constellations over the whole northern and southern hemisphere of the celestial sphere. Okay, keep going here.
Within a few years, Melchizedek had gathered around himself a group of pupils, disciples, and believers who formed the nucleus of the later community of Salem. He was soon known throughout Palestine as the priest of El Elyon, the Most High, and as the Sage of Salem. Among some of the surrounding tribes, he was often referred to as the Sheikh or King of Salem. Salem was the site which, after the disappearance of Melchizedek, became the city of Jebus, subsequently being called Jerusalem.
So a couple things there. See, they're reminding you of how the Hebrews coined that name now for this individual, Melchizedek, King of Righteousness, right? See, they're, you know, like they're just saying, he's referred to as the Sheik or King. Okay, so that's literally, see, they built that into the name they coined for him. And then, so we're starting with nothing. We're getting a little community started, built around him, called Salem. And you know, after he leaves, that morphs, evolves into the city of Jabus, just like you see in the Old Testament. They are clearing up the scholars that wonder if Jabus really is Jerusalem before it was called Jerusalem. They're saying yes, it is. Right, so they're dismissing those scholars that think otherwise. Yeah, so it went from Jabus, and eventually, you know, by the time you've got King David, you know, and whatnot, you've got Jerusalem. Okay.
She's the city of peace.
Yeah. Right, so it's just Melchizedek is who started that being that quote unquote holy place. You know, the King of Righteousness, you know, lived there. So, you know, it becomes a fetish site, right? It becomes, you know, infused with, you know, him in a fetishistic sense, like, you know, like humans thought about it, and it becomes a fetish site.
In personal appearance, Melchizedek resembled the then blended Nadite and Sumerian peoples, being almost 6 feet in height and possessing a commanding presence. He spoke Chaldean and a half a dozen other languages. He dressed much as did the Canaanite priests, except that on his breast he wore an emblem of three concentric circles, the Satanius symbol of the Paradise Trinity. In the course of his ministry, this insignia of three concentric circles became regarded as so sacred by his followers that they never dared to use it, and it was soon forgotten with the passing of a few generations.
Again, you see, it, like I said, with it becoming a fetish site, I mean, everything is like over reverenced, you know, if you will. So here you're seeing what kind of a body they built for him. Okay, so they didn't build, you know, an Adamic-like body. So he wouldn't have been, you know, in that mode. He would have been a blended, see, sort of a like a stock. He's going to have the more chiseled features, you know, in contrast to the pure evolutionary stock that Adam and Eve or the Nadites brought in, and he's got most of that sort of height. You know, notice he's almost 6 feet. So in other words, you know, they're making it very, very as what you'd expect. You know, you blend in some evolutionary stock that's shorter and the higher stock comes down a little bit in height. But still quite, you know, majestic, and you know, he would have had dramatic, you know, chiseled sorts of features. But, you know, I mean, whether or not he had, you know, light hair and blue eyes or something like that, I don't know. He might have had brown eyes, and I don't know. I mean, but you know, we don't know exactly what this blended, you know, implies.
I'm thinking more dark hair and dark eyes.
Yeah, probably, but I don't know. I mean, it just all depends on whether or not, you know, there was lots of, you know, blue-eyed, well-nigh blonde types, you know, and whatnot. I mean, around still, you know. So, you know, you can only speculate on just how, you know, they would have wanted him to be striking, you know. So, I don't know, you know. You can just, you know, speculate as you see fit. But it's kind of interesting that they actually say he was made a little bit more on the Nadite than the Adamite side of an Andite-like stock. Okay, so that seems to kind of suggest that maybe he wasn't quite so definitively. Yeah, he wouldn't have looked like a secondary midwayer if then they make themselves manifest, you know, as strikingly, you know, Adamic-like, perhaps.
Whose physics did they use, or how do they?
That's coming up in the next thing here. Yeah, we'll see here. Yep.
Oh, wait a minute.
Was there something else?
Yeah, I had a question.
Finished it. Oh, okay.
The three concentric circles.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about the three concentric.
You know,
yeah.
To me, I thought there was a banner of Michael, as well as symbol of the Paradise Trinity. That's not the blue against the ash.
No, it is, and. That's something that a lot of your Angelic readers really miss. I wasn't going to get deeply into that because it's focused on very definitive in the next section. So we'll get that next time. But let's just note up front here that he does have these three concentric circles. And like I just said, we'll talk about that next week more in depth when they talk about it. And it's very important, you know, that it's the Paradise Trinity. It's not the three persons. It's the Paradise Trinity. And I'll get into that next time.
Which is still the banner of Michael.
Yeah, it's still the banner of Michael. I mean, it's just that, remember, that's the whole point. It's the banner of Michael because Michael is saying he's putting himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, like the Universal Father does, like everyone should, right? Instead of self-righteousness, self-righteous exaltation, like Lucifer was doing. Yeah.
I think it's funny that, you know, he wore it here.
Mm-hmm.
Like Superman.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
House of
L. Yeah, the House of L. Yeah, there we go, yes.
I just think that's really funny.
Good point. Just notice how we kind of have a sense. We even make, you know, comic book characters kind of in this mode. I mean, you know, the reason that you have the House of El is because El is the name for God, right, in the Near East, right? I mean, right. The comic book is already playing off of that stuff.
Was created speaking all these languages, too.
Yeah, and remember, the Melchizedeks already know all these languages. You know, the Melchizedeks know every language on the planet, you know. But how, there's all the questions of how they, see, when they make, and he's incarnated in this, and so how much do they have to train this agent mind, you know, of the mortal, you know? I mean, apparently they decided they just needed to sort of get it spun up with, you know, with seven languages, because that's all he would be needing locally, you know? There's all those details of how amazing it is to think about making a body and, you know, and having mind engage it and him, you know, meshing into that and everything. It's, you know, crazy to think about. All right, let's keep going here.
Though Machaventa lived after the manner of the men of the realm, he never married, nor could he have left offspring on earth. His physical body, while resembling that of the human male, was in reality on the order of those especially constructed bodies used by the 100 materialized members of Prince Caligastia's staff, except that it did not carry the life plasm of any human race. Nor was there available on Urantia the Tree of Life. Had Machaventa remained for any long period on Earth, his physical mechanism would have gradually deteriorated. As it was, he terminated his bestowal mission in 94 years, long before his material body had begun to disintegrate.
So, no definitive aging over that short span of time. So, like we said up front, they're constructing body just like the prince's staff, except they're not basing it off of the genetics here. In a direct fashion. Most likely, they're just basing it off the generalized genetics of our local system. You know, without the specializations to this world. Yeah, and remember how they achieved that with the prince's staff. I mean, they literally used the genetics of the Andonites, right, as the basis for the genetics of those bodies they built. And you notice they made him non-procreating. Yeah, so he had all the hardware, okay, but, you know, not going to happen. Okay, you know, in the same way they talk about making material bodies for the probationary nursery, but they're non-reproducing. Okay, so they made him with a non-reproducing body.
With no urges.
Well, see again, you know.
We don't know.
We don't know. He may have had, you know, all kinds of physical urges and whatnot, but.
You know, with the Catholic Church, I hear they have some kind of order of Melchizedek or something.
Well, you know, it's not just the Catholic Church, that's in general.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. I just, you know, I've heard of that.
Yeah.
And since they, you know, aren't into priests having sex or anything, generally, it just seems interesting that, you know, he wasn't able to. I don't know, maybe there was some kind of thread.
Well, you know, you've got the stuff, priests after the order of Melchizedek, you know, that's in the book of Hebrews. They'll mention that later on, that spins up some of those things, like the Mormons, you know, thoughts about, you know, priests after the order of Melchizedek, you know, rather than other modes. And
I think it was a translation issue,
yeah.
The celibate.
Yeah, celibrate, yeah.
I thought you were going to say transvestite.
No, the word was celebrate, not celibate. So anyway, I mean, that's the answer to your question. It's some generalized local system genetics, nothing specific to this world. Because it doesn't need to literally sync up. Remember, the prince's staff were going to be, you know, procreating, you know, with the first generation of the Adamites and stuff. So it needed to sync up very definitively with the genetics here. All right, and then we've got a little bit more here.
This incarnated Melchizedek received a thought adjuster who indwelt his superhuman personality as the monitor of time and the mentor of the flesh, thus gaining that experience and practical introduction to Urantian problems and to the technique of indwelling an incarnated son, which enabled this spirit of the Father to function so valiantly in the human mind of the later Son of God, Michael, when he appeared on earth in the likeness of mortal flesh. And this is the only thought adjuster who ever functioned in two minds on Urantia. But both minds were divine as well as human.
Yeah, so that fact that they need lots of experience to work effectively, like we've talked about before, I mean, to have actual experience, that adjuster experiencing working with and, you know, not, you know, someone who wasn't purely human, allowed him to have such an efficient interface with Jesus, you know, so to be able to foster that so that, you know, Jesus could go through the psychic circles as rapidly as he did and all that sort of stuff. I mean, if that adjuster hadn't gotten training in Machaventa, you know, they probably would have killed Jesus before he could have gotten to third circler. That process would have been spread out over too long a span of time, you know. He was very efficient, and boom, 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 Jesus gets the first circler, and it's because of all that precise training the adjuster got there. And like I said, he obviously didn't fuse with that adjuster, Machaventa, but that soul, you know, infused into his nature, and he's now the super additive consequence of the relationship between what he was and that soul. So he's a different type of being now. Let's see, anything else there? I think we got everything there, didn't we? You know, why did they say the only thought adjuster who ever functioned in two minds? You know, they're always wanting to make sure you don't go off on that tangent of, oh, that's what past life stuff is about or something like that. You know, that's my adjuster was here before. It's like, no, it has nothing to do with that. Right. You know, we've talked before about most likely, if there is a valid, you know, past life thing that's being dredged up, you know, how that happens. It doesn't have anything to do with adjusters or recycled souls or anything like that. Right, we're a complicated phenomenon that has a lot of avenues for such things to possibly happen if they're valid. Okay, but that's why they're throwing it, you know, just because especially back in the days of this, spiritualism of, you know, when this book was going about, you know, they definitely needed to say something about that. All right, final little bit here.
Well,
you got something?
I like that term for the thought adjuster, mentor of the flesh.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's,
yeah.
I don't ever remember that anywhere else.
Yeah. I just, you know, like I was saying and thinking about how I was doing it, it's kind of mentoring that frame for your mind so that what's within that frame works oh so much better.
During the incarnation in the flesh, Machaventa was in full contact with his 11 fellows of the Corps of Planetary Custodians, but he could not communicate with other orders of celestial personalities. Aside from the Melchizedek receivers, he had no more contact with superhuman intelligences than a human being.
So that's another interesting little footnote. See, I mean, if he just, you know, morphed into a physical manifestation, you know, he would have still been in full, you know, he could have, you know, communicated with the seraphim, the cherubim, and, you know, everyone else, right? But he gets really, you know, imprisoned in many ways, see, down within that adjutant mind. And, I mean, his inner core of his Melchizedek nature still has a direct line of engagement with the other Melchizedeks, right?
So if he need to know something.
But, right, he'd have to get it, you know, if he's going to know about what some seraphim is saying, it's got to be secondhand through another Melchizedek, right? So that's an interesting little tidbit, too, see, that, and so that just adds to how much he appreciates where we are and what we're consigned to think within, and also makes it so that he doesn't come off as weird, because, you know, if he was in, you know, every time Jesus would, you know, in his, during his, you know, post-baptism, you know, sort of during his public ministry, when he would sort of, you know, use his Michael nature to communicate with things, you know, he'd get this weird kind of freaky, you know, nature to him, and everyone is going, oh boy, what's going on with Jesus, you know, and it was kind of freaking him out. So, you know, Machaventa wouldn't be doing that, you know, where, you know, he's like a crazy person talking to himself or something, you know, because he seems to be in some sort of communication with no one. So again, he's you know, he and that also adds to what they said in the preceding paragraph. The thought adjuster is getting a very proper experience in how to work with a mind that is, you know, so bounded off from the bigger picture, like our minds are. Yeah. Right? That adjuster has to work in a very small little prison space. Right? And so that adjuster was learning how to work in Jesus' little, you know, initial mind.
Yep. Can you imagine Jesus' bestowal really being able to proceed without Melchizedek just jumping in the way he did?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if he had all that, those details in his.
Yeah, I'm sure they, Melchizedek, weren't thinking, well, someone's got to do this because Michael's going to need an adjuster.
Right.
No, it's coincidentally, no. Right? That the adjuster that Michael needed just was perfectly that adjuster.
Personalized adjuster.
Yeah.
Another part of the book, and they actually conjecture that did some serving between.
Oh Michael, yeah. And
Jesus,
oh yeah. Right.
And some other areas.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
15 mm-hmm. other incarnations.
Well, that was maybe before, but I mean, just anyway.
But anyway, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's
now is the head of all personalized adjusters in our universe.
It's a simple little reminder that in supremacy there are no coincidences, right? It's like all these things, you know, well, the Melchizedeks kind of arbitrarily sort of decide to do this, that, and the other thing. Well, coincidentally, that all just fits in. Everything is coordinated, you know, at a very high level. And it all works together so that in the end, the grand universe is settled in light and life.
Yeah, just thinking from that perception that you said the adjuster kind of chiseled or worked within the mind of
mm-hmm.
a Christ. It could also be a Luciferian thought, couldn't it? It's adjusting.
Well, yeah, we don't have time to.
Consciousness or something, but no, it's you know, a professor could be looked at that way from the Catholic Church, right?
Yeah.
Adjusting someone's mind to be with God.
Let's wrap this up here, and we could talk a little bit about that after. I don't want to go too long here for for wrapping this official session up. We do some Q&A afterwards here. That's a whole kind of can of worms to open up, for me to do in 30 seconds. But let's just let's wrap it there, and we'll pick up more next time here. Let's take a moment here, everyone.